Welcome to the Natural Alternative Podcast. I'm your host, Madonna Guy. Today I have with me Dr. Christine Houghton. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Madonna. I appreciate it.
Absolutely welcome. Christine has a long history in the combination of natural therapies, antioxidants, creating and developing products that really have phenomenal success working in the body. So how did you get into that, Christine?
Well, it's interesting, Madonna, because I spent almost 30 years in clinical practice in nutritional medicine, and I left practice in 2004, and that was the same year the term nutrigenomics was coined. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but it turned out that that became very relevant later on. So I got involved in research after I left the clinic, and I discovered that there's some remarkable molecules naturally occurring in a whole lot of plants, including plant foods. And these plant foods, with these molecules, they send signals into our cells, and it's those signals that change the way our DNA expression occurs. And so where we've thought for decades that a lot of nutrition was dependent on vitamins and minerals and so on, and it still is, there was this whole new component of food molecules which actually talk to our genes. So this term nutrigenomics is nutra as in food, genomics, genes, DNA. So this concept of signaling has just completely changed the way I've looked at nutrition or nutritional medicine, so much so that we've recently developed the Institute of Nutrigenomic Medicine as a means of giving clinicians that added level of relevant science, which they can use to build on what they already do. It doesn't throw anything out, but it certainly gives us another tool in our toolbox. And it's a tool which really is most compatible with the way nature promotes natural repair and healing in human cells.
And I would imagine, especially new practitioners, the way they're taught these days is more to be like a doctor, but a naturopath. So they're being taught to only look at blood work, only the clinical view, whereas it's almost like that combination of old-fashioned nutrition, gee, we are what we eat, plus the science behind that, which is so relevant now, coming together beautifully and proving that our food is one of the most important things, and those nutrients within the foods are so important to our gene health. You know, there's a doctor who I've studied with a lot over the years, Dr. Charles Krebs. He's a kinesiologist and he's retiring now, but he remembered going back about 20 or 30 years ago, there was some research that they were looking at doctors going through med school, and they asked him a bunch of questions about diet and nutrition and whether people thought that that sort of thing was important for people's health. And when doctors first went to university, they believed that it was important. And by the time, and I can't remember, just say 80% of people thought, yes, nutrition is important. But by the time they got through their med school, it was like less than 10% thought nutrition and diet was important. So it had almost been like the whole time they were in that medical industry, they were primed that, you know, what we can do for our health is nothing from a dietary perspective, must be all big pharma.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because I think I know why that's happened. I think it's happened because of the way biochemistry is taught at university, because I was taught in that model as well. It's very laboratory based. It has very little clinical relevance. And it was only that I was already very interested in nutritional biochemistry before I went to university to study biochemistry. So I already had some preconceived ideas. And I often say I would love the chance to teach biochemistry to medical students, because I think I have enough arguments that are persuasive enough that they would have to see the role of food molecules in human health. In fact, you can't not see it. Once it's pointed out to you and once you're taught in a way that's actually meaningful. I got to the end of a 3-year biochemistry degree And I had very little taught to me of real clinical relevance. We did a subject called clinical biochemistry in third year, but it was really just about interpreting lab tests. And as you say, a lot of practitioners now, even in the natural medicine fields, are becoming surrogate doctors. They're feeling that they need to do lots of testing, and those tests now give them a blueprint for what sort of supplements they prescribe. Yes. That's just a mirror image of the medical model. You do a lot of pathology tests and you prescribe some drugs, some pharmaceuticals. To me, that is not what nutritional medicine is all about. And something else you said a little earlier harks back to my early days in practice. So when I started practice a very long time ago in 1975, there were very few supplements on the market at that stage. So what we did, we had to do with food. And so I very quickly gained a very healthy respect, if you like, for the role of food in human health. We could do things with food that we can still do. But unfortunately, along the way, big supplement has come in and mirrored big pharma. And big supplements started to say in the 70s, there's nothing left in your food, therefore buy our supplements.
Yes.
And while there are elements of truth in that, the soil is being overused, it's being over-chemicalized with agricultural chemicals. There are some nutrients which are in lesser supply. Yes, that's true. But to what degree is that true? The reality is a plant won't grow if it hasn't got its core nutrients. And if we eat a decent supply of plant foods across a wide enough variety, if you miss the selenium out of that one that came from Victoria, you picked it up from the food that came from some other location. So the variety and the diversity of your diet is what ensures that you get all of those nutrients, even if food is lacking. What we didn't know back in the 70s is these phytochemicals, which is a posh word for plant chemicals, and there are about 10,000 different identified chemicals in plants, and these are these signaling molecules which are activating protective genes and down-regulating disease-promoting genes. So that's this whole field of nutrigenomics, which completely changes the way we think. And from my perspective, having started out early in my career with not much more than food to work with, and having been carried along with the orthomolecular medicine and the mega vitamin therapy movements, sadly, I've now come right back the full circle. And I'm back to looking at the value of food, which I didn't really lose, but I don't use those vitamin and mineral supplements anymore the way we're encouraged to do. I'm more likely now to use food supplements which have specific nutrigenomic activity. So I want to use the supplements that are activating the protective mechanisms in the cells. So that's been a complete change for me, and I guess it'll take a little while before that filters into the professional community of clinicians in this field, because it does take a little while to get your head around the fact that some of the things we did back in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and some people still are doing, in my opinion, are not really appropriate.
Yes.
So instead of looking at trying to get as many antioxidants as possible in supplements and foods, which is what a lot of clinicians focus on, I'm more interested in looking at what I can do to promote the mechanisms of cell defense. So if I can understand what keeps one cell in the body healthy, what it needs to function at its peak, I can do that to every cell, because I can't select one cell. What I do to one cell, I do to the entire body. So we call this a focus on upstream factors. We're trying to go up as high up the chain as possible in cell function to understand how cells work in nature.
And we try that you're helping to reduce inflammation and increase detoxification and
Yes.
Get our cellular
those
energy
core principles, what we focus on. And we say what we're trying to do is we're trying to restore homeostasis in cells, which just means the natural balance of nature. Whereas we've thought for decades that if we gave the cell heaps of antioxidants, that's what it wanted. Well, in fact, that's not what it wants. It doesn't want that at all. What cells want are signaling molecules. So a healthy cell needs to detect when there's some sort of a threat to it. So it could be, you know, you might be out in the sun getting sunburned. So that ultraviolet radiation is a threat to the function of the cell. That ultraviolet radiation sends a signal. When we exercise, we need more oxygen. We're producing more free radical superoxide. That's a signal that says to the body, if you keep doing this, staying out in the sun, doing too much exercise, eating junk food, you are going to create cell damage. So those early signals or indicators of damage are what the cell detects. And then it says, okay, I need to switch on all my defensive mechanisms all at once, of which antioxidants is just one of many. I need to switch all these protective processes on and I'll get through this. And the sunburn will clear and it'll heal up naturally. It won't do me any real damage. The exercise won't do me any real damage. So it's really just a different way of looking at what food molecules do. And so if we choose the appropriate food molecules, we can send these subtle signals to our cells that, so that we can enhance these protective processes. And, you know, they're in foods. Some foods contain more of these signaling molecules than others. We don't even really need to know what they are because living the ideal lifestyle, eating lots of the appropriate foods, fresh, natural foods, unprocessed foods, fresh air, sunshine, exercise, those and sleep, those principles of nature, they seem very simplistic, but there's such a lot of good science behind them. And if we can use food to send those signals, we can improve the function of our cells overall. So lots of sicknesses can be healed or diseased cells can be repaired in this way. And we can keep that process going even as we age because our genetic processes tend to get a little bit sluggish as we get older. And even though there's no such thing as anti-aging, we do have a process which we can call healthy aging. So we can keep those processes going much longer into the later years and try to avoid the very common sicknesses which most people develop as they age.
Yes. Yeah, so I suppose what we're, so this is like epigenetics. We're using the foods to change the environment within our genes.
Epigenetics is a sub-branch of nutrigenomics. So with epigenetics, it's like little paper clips that we put on certain genes. So if you put this epigenetic paperclip on a gene, you switch that gene off and it can't be read. What your DNA is doing inside every cell is it's like a big library of all of these genes. And signals activate that DNA to start producing certain proteins, usually enzymes. With epigenetics, that's where generational shifts can carry on. There's lots of interesting stories where there was an Irish potato famine way back a century or so ago, and those people virtually starved. Lots of terrible things happened, and you think, okay, so when they recovered and they got healthy food again, life would go on, but it didn't. What actually happened is in women who were pregnant at that time or pregnant soon after, those epigenetic changes were carried along on the genes of the offspring. So if you imagine there's little paper clips then that epigenetically got onto the child's genes, then certain things don't function when that child gets into an adulthood. So through no fault of their own, they didn't go through a potato famine. They still have restrictions in their function. And the way it affected a lot of people, and this applies to this very day, is when people are subjected to famine, the body pulls out a whole lot of protective mechanisms so that it enables them to use the tiny amount of food that they have more efficiently. When they come out of that famine and they start eating the levels of food they would have eaten before, it is very easy for them to become obese. And that's what often happens when these epigenetic tags are carried on to the next generation. Those children might have just eaten a normal health-promoting diet, but found that they have a lot of difficulty keeping their weight under control, not knowing they're carrying these epigenetic tags on their DNA that stops their metabolism from burning food the way it should. They're basically still programmed for a famine that doesn't exist.
And can that be changed through nutrigenomics?
It can be changed. It's more difficult, and we know less about epigenetics than we do about the direct signaling nutrigenomic processes that I mentioned to you before. We have less ability to specifically control the epigenetic markers, but it isn't impossible.
Right. Okay. And we were chatting before we started about the misinformation out there around antioxidants. Do you want to chat a little bit about that?
Yes, I would actually, because a lot of people have thought that, you know, the more antioxidants you can get, the better. And you only have to go to the supermarket and you'll find boxes of cereal and who knows what food with high in antioxidants proudly stamped on the label. And, of course, if they're proudly stamping that on the label, you'd assume that that's a good thing and that's what you need. So what actually happens is within our cells we have genes that enable us to produce antioxidant enzymes. Those enzymes are literally millions of times more powerful in their effect than the antioxidants that we get out of vitamin supplements or oranges or pomegranates or any food which is rich in naturally occurring antioxidants. So the cell's preference is to make its own antioxidant enzymes when it needs them. We still use the antioxidants that come with the food, but they do different things and they're nowhere near powerful enough to do all the things the cell needs to do to protect itself. So the link is this. For us to produce our own antioxidant enzymes, our cells have to be under some sort of a threat. So we'll go back to the exercising thing. So let's suppose you and I are going for a jog down the road and we're just gently jogging, but we're starting to puff a little more, we're breathing more oxygen. Every time we breathe in oxygen, we produce some superoxide radical, and that's sometimes we call that a free radical. But that radical is not the bad molecule we've always attributed it to be. It's actually the signal. That superoxide now activates some switches inside the cell, and it's those switches which now go and tell the DNA, make some antioxidant and other protective enzymes. So that's naturally how Mother Nature takes care of us if we're exercising. Now, there's a very interesting study which was done some years ago in Germany. And what they did is they took some young athletic males and divided them into two groups. And they were measuring metabolic markers. So basically they wanted to see various blood tests that could tell whether these young men were likely to become diabetic or likely to have heart disease or any of those sorts of disease-promoting signals related to being overweight and underfit and not healthy. So one group got 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day and 400 milligrams of vitamin E and did an intensive exercise program. The other group just did the intensive exercise program and took no vitamins. What the research group expected to find at the end of the study was that the ones on the vitamins would do better than the ones who just did the exercise. They were amazed because they actually had the reverse effect. The ones doing the exercise got all the predictable benefits to their metabolism of exercise, The one on the 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C and the 400 units of vitamin E had no benefit. So you go, why? Why would that happen? The reason it happens is that the signal that's telling the cell to upregulate its defenses is a weak prooxidant signal. When you dump high levels of antioxidant vitamins into the cell, they are antioxidant. The signal the cell is using is prooxidant. Those antioxidants have completely masked that signal. So when the young men were doing their exercise program, their cells did not realize they had to upregulate their internal defenses and produce protective molecules. So that was 2009 that study was done, and it's completely changed the way we must look at isolated antioxidant supplements. Now, if you look at a 1,000 milligram vitamin C dose, that could be one or two tablets, maybe even four tablets, but it's easy enough to get 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, and a lot of people consume much more than that, thinking that that's what their cells want. You could not get easily get 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C out of your food daily. You'd have to eat 16 pretty large oranges to do that, and there's probably not too many people who do it. But more importantly, an orange is just not vitamin C. An orange has heaps of other molecules in it. So this concept of micromanaging cells by giving isolated vitamin doses, as in a supplement, it just doesn't happen in nature. It just does not happen. It cannot happen. So I think we've taken the wrong pathway in doing that. What I've learned as I've gone out of clinic and more into research phase is that the more we can mimic the way nature does things, the better we are. So what would nature do? Well, nature has this beautiful built-in mechanism. If I stress my body a little bit, it's going to switch on my defensive mechanisms. If you and I were doing our jog down the road and then we decided that we'd compete in the marathon tomorrow, we would then bypass our cells' ability to deal with that stress. That then becomes overly stressing of the cells, what we call oxidative stress, and that's where we start producing enormous amounts of inflammation and lots of tissue damage. Some of that tissue damage can even damage the DNA permanently. So we're back to the idea of looking at signaling molecules in food as the way nature defends cellular function and cell health.
So then therefore with foods, do you talk about the whole superfood things? Like, is that sort of where you go with your research?
I do not. I absolutely do not.
Yes.
There's no such thing as a superfood. It's nonsense. It gives this impression that here's this one food with magical properties that's going to do things. I mean, the celery juice diet has got to be a case in point. Why just pick on celery? There's no such thing. I mentioned earlier that the diversity of food is really the key. If we want to even consider the term superfoods, which I don't, I would include a large number of foods which are unprocessed and unrefined. We do enormous damage to our food supply by refining and processing. And I think the cereal island supermarket has got to be one of the worst offenders because we start out with a grain of wheat or rice or corn or whatever the cereal is, and that little grain is a seed which will grow an entire plant. It comes packed with all of the nutrients it needs to get put into the soil, put some water on, and for that to grow a young plant. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. It comes with all those nutrients. So when we eat that food, we take the advantage of having all of those vitamins and minerals and all the other phytochemicals and so on that are in that plant that are necessary to grow a whole plant. Admittedly, it's got to then start drawing nutrients out of the soil, minerals out of the soil as it gets larger, but it comes with this little pack of nutrients. So when we refine it, what have we got with, say, a grain of wheat? All the grains are much the same. So they have an outer hull of about 11 layers of the tough outer bran coats, which are very rich in nutrients except for the cellulose on the very outside. We have the little germ, which germinates, and that's really rich in lots of nutrients, natural vitamin E and a whole host of other nutrients are there in the germ. And then the bulky part of the seed is the starch. When we refine wheat to make flour, we throw away all the 11 layers of bran, we throw away the germ, and we just eat the white starch. So in their infinite wisdom, health authorities then say, okay, well, we stripped out all the vitamin B1, the B2, the B3 and the iron. Let's put that back in the form of synthetic vitamins. But they forgot to tell you, they stripped out a whole heap of other nutrients as well and they didn't put them back in. So this idea of, you know, enriched cereal, and I think we've all seen the ads, this food has been enriched with vitamin B1, B2, B3 and iron, which is half your daily requirements. Mm-hmm. It's a lie. It is just a lie. So I think it's really unfortunate that, you know, the modern food industry, which has a lot of things in its favour, has actually destroyed a lot of natural foods. I mean, you can go and buy a packet of lentils or chickpeas or something like that. They're also seeds. They're also rich sources of nutrients. They're cheapest chips. You know, people say, oh, you know, I can't afford to eat all this health food. Yes, you can. You just stop buying the packaged stuff and you're paying for all of the mechanization that went into making that, and you start using the ingredients of nature. That's not to say you don't use anything out of a bottle or a packet or a can, but it's about balance. I can remember being horrified in clinical practice when I'd be talking to patients about their diet, and it was not unusual to say to someone, you know, what do you have for your evening meal? And they'd say, pasta. So how do you prepare that? So we buy a bottle of pasta sauce and we boil some noodles and we put the two together. That's dinner. So do you have a salad or some greens or some other vegetables with that? No. I said, we have pasta. And, you know, that's influenced by the Mediterranean culinary tradition. But there's no way a Mediterranean diet would just be a bowl of some sort of pasta with some sort of sauce on it. There's always a side salad. It's always got vinegar and olive oil and fresh olives and maybe dried tomatoes and other bits and pieces. One of the important differences between the traditional Mediterranean diet and the modern Australian or American or otherwise Western diet is the traditional Mediterranean diet contains four times more fruit and vegetables than ours does.
Yeah.
And I think if we did nothing else in the name of nutrition but tried to mimic that larger quantity, particularly of vegetables and fruit, I think we would fix a lot of things doing nothing else on a population basis. We just don't eat the plant foods. That's the reality of it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
With the Mediterranean, they weren't vegetarians. They didn't eat a lot of meat, but a lot of that was because a lot of those people were very poor. So they grew a lot of their own produce and they used lots of legumes, you know, kidney beans and chickpeas and lentils and so on in meals. But they would always do something like have a lamb shank that was cooked through with the pot of vegetables, like a minestrone soup. So there was always some animal protein there. They'd usually have poultry, they'd have their own eggs. So when you start to look at deconstructing the Mediterranean diet, it's a wonderful model for our diet or what our diet could be, even though the traditional Mediterranean diet does tend to use a lot of white bread and a lot of pasta, but they have so much other vegetable food tends to offset any adverse effects of that.
Yes. Where do you sit on GMOs when it comes to how they're affecting our bodies?
Well, I don't like to do anything that interferes with nature because I think we don't understand what the long-term consequences might be. So, no, I'm not in favour of using GMO and also not in favour of glyphosate, which allegedly is supposed to be harmless for humans, but it does terrible things to our microbiota. And, of course, if we don't have a healthy gut microbiome, our immune system is adversely affected. So I just try to work with nature as far as possible. It'd be nice if we could all eat organic food every day, but we can't. It isn't practical for, it's not practical for most families with, you know, maybe mum, dad and two kids to be able to eat large quantities of organic food across a wide range of different foods. And unfortunately, I think there are people who take literally the need to eat an organic diet and in so doing actually reduce the quantity of vegetables they're eating. So I think there's a balance somewhere where it's important to get this broad diversity of different plant foods in the diet. It's important to get a pretty large proportion of your diet as plant foods. But if it means you have to have supermarket vegetables and you can't always have organic, then I think it's better, and that's my opinion, I don't have a study on this, it's better to have large quantities of plant food, whether it's organic or not. And the reason that I say that is when we activate these switches within the cell, and the switch that I mentioned before that produces the antioxidant enzymes, that same switch produces detoxification enzymes. So if we're going to be taking in agricultural chemicals on our food, which is inevitable, even organic food is not completely devoid of agricultural residue, the more efficiently those detoxification enzymes are functioning, the more readily we're going to break down those waste materials and get rid of them.
Yeah, I remember when I was in Beijing and we were on a bus coming into and on the side of the roads, and you could see this plume of pollution over Beijing. And there were these things on the side of the road, organic pomegranates, organic this, organic that. And I thought, there's nothing organic about that. You know, it's like sitting in the pollution to be sold. And it was just a real one of those moments when you realize that everything that's in the environment, and I heard that we take in about 40% of our glyphosate from breathing it in, because it's just in our atmosphere these days. It's simply everywhere. So we have to keep those details.
I haven't heard that, Madonna, but what concerns me is not only is glyphosate used as a herbicide for destroying weeds in the soil, it's also used as a desiccant to dehydrate harvested grains. So when foods like oats and barley are stored in huge silos, they add glyphosate to that to reduce the mold to form. So that's shock horror. Something I do insist on buying organically is oats. I like to use oats, and I only use organic oats.
Is there anything else in your... So, you know, there's the list of clean 15 and dirty dozen that sort of come out every year, that have the lowest percentage, like the clean 15, the lowest percentage of pesticide per weight, or the dirty dozen that have the highest percentage of pesticides per weight. Do you tend to look at certain foods and think, okay, well, I'll spend my budget for organics on these ones because I know that they're the worst? Like, do you have certain ones that you will...
No, I don't, because that's American data, that dirty dozen thing. It's not ours. So their data changes every year anyway. I don't know how reliable it is even throughout the year. I mean, it's changing all the time. It depends which farmer grew it in which farm and where it came from. So I'm sorry, I don't take any notice of it. I really don't know.
Yes.
A food like broccoli, for example, usually comes up on the clean list, and I'm suspicious of that because if you look at the surface of the broccoli vegetable, it's got such a wide surface area, all those tiny little florets. So whatever residue of pesticides being dusted onto those plants, it's got plenty of places to attach on a food like broccoli or cauliflower. So I really don't know. The other problem we have is that a lot of people think you can just wash this off. You really don't. And a lot of it's embedded into the structure of the plants. So I don't know how we get it out. Interestingly, going back to broccoli, the stalk of the broccoli actually concentrates those pesticides. I've sort of been one of these people who munches on bits of capsicum and broccoli as I'm cooking dinner, just, you know, cut a bit off here and a bit off there. And I began to notice years ago that the stalk of the broccoli's got an awful chemical taste. And when I investigated that, I discovered it's because it's tending to concentrate the pesticide residue. So I've learned not to do that.
Yeah. And I think people don't understand the whole thing about genetically modified. Like, it's in the seed. There's often antibiotics in the seed. So then as the seed grows, there's antibiotics within the plant.
Yes, that, and also the DNA is being modified in those plants. And so I don't think we know what effect a modified DNA has on us as humans, what effect it has on our cells. We've not been traditionally exposed to that. I mean, we've had hundreds of thousands of years to become genetically adapted to the foods that are naturally produced by nature, even by, you know, natural breeding processes where different varieties are bred. When you start manipulating the DNA, no, I don't know what that does, and I don't think anybody else knows what that does.
Do you remember the story of the banana babies? Were you at... Have you heard that story with the genetic modification? It was after World War One, I believe, when they genetically modified two grains. So one was from Italy, one was from Greece, I believe. And they basically GMO'd them together to get longer strains of protein.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a longer strain of protein than there had ever been. And all of a sudden, they didn't know what was causing it, but some babies were dying. So they called them the banana babies. And they're on the spiral. I remember at a metagenics seminar one year, they showed us the spiral of this genetically modified wheat protein. And there were like several areas on the protein where it caused apoptosis. So basically you eat these grains, they go into your tummy, it destroys some gut cells. Obviously some people, you know, coped with it, some people didn't. But they were sort of finding that in these Western countries, some babies were getting big, fat, bloated bellies. They knew there was a huge amount of dysbiosis going on. They didn't know what was causing it. And they became known as banana babies because it spread out throughout the medical industry. If you fed them nothing but bananas, because bananas seemed to be safe, then they would survive. And then I was on 4BC about 10 years ago, and I was telling that story, and one lady rang in and she said, "My grandma was a banana baby." I'm like, wow, that's so cool. So, yeah, so, but it was basically, that was the first time, I believe, that they genetically modified wheat.
Okay, I think we have to stop trying to micromanage nature, because that's what we're doing.
Yes.
Within these mechanisms within cells, so there's all these complicated biochemical pathways, we think we can drop a molecule in there in large dose and it'll change something. But it's changing a whole host of other things. We don't know what those other things are. I mean, in pharmaceutical medicine, we say they've got side effects. But we can do the same thing with using the wrong supplements. We can do the same thing perhaps with genetically modified food. In nature, there's always checks and balances. So, you know, you naturally increase, say, the glutathione levels in your cells by activating these switches we mentioned before. But nature just won't keep on producing glutathione, because it'll go, okay, I've done what I needed, now we can just stop the glutathione production for a while, and when we need some more, we'll make some more. So this constant nanosecond to nanosecond modulation that's going on within cells, you know, put the brakes on, put the accelerator on, a little bit more, a little bit less, We have no ability whatsoever to even understand that level of control, let alone have any ability to manipulate it. And I think we try hard to micromanage things we have no ability to control. And I think you've only got to look at the fact that there are so many drug adverse effects reported every year. There's something like, at last count, 18,000 deaths every year in Australia from drug adverse effects, and something like 50,000 people who are permanently disabled as a consequence of side effects from drugs.
Yes.
The Americans claim that drug side effects is the third leading cause of death in America. We don't report it in the same way, but I suspect it's the third or the fourth, even though we don't own up to that. So,
yeah, so I do believe that humans are trying to do all sorts of weird things to our food where they believe they're doing some good things. I remember when they increased lectins in grains, was it in the 80s? And they never told anyone how much they were increasing lectins by. And the idea was that because it's a natural pesticide that we would need less pesticides. And of course that didn't work because nature is clever. So we now use 3 to 6 times the amount of pesticides that we did before they increased the lectins. And the lectins can destroy the little, you know, villi in the intestines and, you know, it just messes with things.
Which is back to my micromanaging story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, yes. Each time they think they're doing a good thing. And I remember being at another conference one year, and it was the year when Obama actually stopped any research into GMOs. He did not want any more research to go into whether or not they were good or bad. At that point, it was like, nope, they're good, leave it alone. I'm sure that's not what he thought, but that's what he did. So, yeah.
We would know, yes.
And I do think that was around 2010 or something like that, but it was quite a while ago.
And can I say something else about antioxidants that I didn't get to say before? I don't want to give the wrong impression that the naturally occurring antioxidants in food are not beneficial. They are. It's when we try to isolate them and concentrate them and take them in large doses of supplements that we can cause the problem. But something that's really important to know, I mean, for years or, you know, even about 10 years ago, I think blueberries were very trendy. It was supposed to be this really high antioxidant food. Blueberries are very rich in a big, bulky molecule we call a polyphenol. And in the lab, blueberries have a very potent antioxidant effect. But when we take them as food, they're such big bulky molecules, very few of those molecules get into our cells. So they're not antioxidants in our body as we thought they were. What they are is they're potent antioxidants in the gut itself. And what I mean by that is they are neutralizing potentially oxidative or carcinogenic molecules in our food. So let's suppose we went to a barbecue and the steak was pretty black. Those blackened molecules are known to be highly carcinogenic or cancer-forming. So if you've got some polyphenol in your gut, let's suppose you'd had blueberries you'd eaten just around about the same time, or any of the other polyphenol molecules, which I'll come back to, if you've eaten at the same time, those antioxidants will neutralise the free radicals that are in that blackened steak. So if they're neutralising them in the gut, there's less of that toxic molecule to get absorbed into the cells. So even though the polyphenol from the blueberries or whatever didn't get into the cells, it's doing its job in the gut. This comes back to the benefit of marinating meats before you barbecue them. So lots of plant foods are very rich in these polyphenols. You could marinate in red wine, which is commonly what's done. Olive oil has these polyphenols. So you could be marinating in red wine and olive oil. You could put some lemon zest in there, some lime zest, some ginger, some chili. Whole combination of these polyphenols, that's sitting in the meat for an hour or so, absorbed into it before you cook it, and you have that benefit of doing that. So I think marinating is a lovely technique that is best not done with some sort of a bottle sauce that you bought on the shelf of the supermarket, but pretty easy to make.
Yeah.
Just home with a few fundamental ingredients. So, you know, the French have been attributed as having low heart disease because of the red wine that they drink. And it's a nice story and it's a good excuse for people to drink red wine. But in truth, any of those polyphenols will do the same job. You could have a glass of beetroot juice, which has got a very similar type of molecule in it. You could have had the handful of blueberries or strawberries. So, again, back to this idea, the greater the variety.
You're talking the rainbow-coloured diet. You know, all the colours of the rainbow.
Yes, you could call it that, yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly the red and the purple and the orange foods, they're very rich polyphenol sources. Yes. But there are different molecules in different foods. Garlic and the broccoli family, all the cruciferous vegetables, they're a totally different structure altogether. They have an enzyme in them, and that enzyme enables that food, as soon as you bite or chew on it, like you cut a slice of garlic, you've immediately started a chemical reaction that produces this protective compound from the garlic. You do the same thing. You munch on a bit of raw broccoli or a bit of raw cauliflower, you've activated this enzyme and you've produced this protective molecule. So you don't have to know all this science. You just have to know you need lots of plant food across a wide variety, growing in as natural a condition as you possibly can. From my perspective, I've got really absorbed in the science of it, and I find it fascinating that what's been known for thousands of years by traditional people who knew none of the science, we are now starting to say, aha, so that's why that happens. So we're attaching the science to it.
So people who are only on plant-based diets, do you believe that they can do that long-term totally healthily, like just plant-based diet and nothing else?
Well, if I give you my opinion, you'll have plenty of people who shout me down, but I'll take the risk. No, I don't. I don't think humans were genetically engineered to be eating a vegan diet. The very fact that a vegan has to take a vitamin B12 supplement to be healthy tells me that nature really didn't want people to eat only plant food.
Yeah.
You don't have to eat a lot of animal food, but you do need to have some. I mean, not only B12, but iron and zinc, they're easy to get out of animal foods. They're very difficult. B12 you can't, but the iron and zinc, it's quite difficult to get out of plant food. The other things, the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids like the fish oils, they come out of not just fish but other animal foods. You can't get them out of plant food. People will tell you that they use linseed, flaxseed to get their omega-3.
And hemp.
What they're not understanding is they're not the long chain. There's a couple more steps that have to lengthen the chain of that fatty acid to be the equivalent of the EPA and DHA that we get from fish and meat. The other thing is there's some enzymes in our, or there's some genes, I should say, in our cells, a couple of genes that enable us to lengthen that shorter chain flax oil to the longer chain fish oil equivalent. But those genes are very, very inefficient. Even in a person with the optimum gene variant, they're very inefficient and it's nearly impossible to produce enough of that fatty acid. Many people have SNPs, which means they have variations in the normal gene that make them even less efficient. Yeah. So, no, long answer to your short question, I don't believe we can exist entirely on plant food.
Yes, no, that's what I found clinically as well.
Yeah. Mind you, you'll find there's some bodybuilders and some athletes who say, I've been vegan for umpteen years and look at me, I'm fabulous.
Yes.
I don't know whether they're taking a heap of supplements as well. They don't usually say. But if we're just going to look at food, no, a vegan diet doesn't cut it very easily. And if you decide you want to be the optimum vegan, you have to spend hours and hours in the kitchen. It is not an easy diet.
Yes.
You can't just go to the supermarket and get what you need to do it healthily. You do have to spend a lot of time soaking legumes and doing all sorts of things of that kind. So
our delightful Billy Gates wanting us all to start eating genetically modified plant-based proteins and to stop
eating. Well, he does, but I think he also wants us to eat insects. So yes. I'm not so keen on crunching through cockroach shells. Yeah.
Why would we say yes to that? It's so bizarre.
Yeah. Apparently, whoever's proposing this at the moment, I heard the other day, they're saying you only need 14 grams of meat a day. Now, if I think that the palm of my hand is, say, 100 grams of steak, 14 grams is probably just one small mouthful.
Yeah. Well, a heap
doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
No, it doesn't.
We're nothing to marinate, will we, at that rate?
Oh, it's a crazy time on the planet with all sorts of agendas going on. Yeah. So with people increasing these plant-based biochemicals in their body from their rainbow colours of food, what improvements would people feel in their bodies? Like what sort of things get switched on and switched off in the body?
Well, if you're going to activate the primary cellular switch that I've been talking about, it governs the function of about 500 protective genes. The thing about it is when you eat those foods that activate that switch, you're switching on about 500 genes all at the same time. Mm. So you're going to improve the function of every cell in your body. I started out saying that earlier. And really, I can't tell you what you're going to feel because somebody may have severe skin rashes, let's say, and they might find that that rash will clear up because now they're optimizing cell function. Somebody else gets asthma. They should find that that clears up. Somebody else has high blood pressure will normalize. It's really this, it's not disease-based, it's cell function-based. And if you're improving cell function, whatever the weaknesses are of that person should improve. And that's why I'm not in favor of taking a new patient and doing a whole host of testing. Because I need to fix that primary cell function before I do anything else. So let's suppose someone presents with gut problems and thyroid problems and skin rashes, just as an example. Why would I go out and test all the parameters associated with those diseases when I've just got to have a look at their diet and lifestyle and health history and realise that there's so many things I need to fix first before I even consider the name of the disease? When you're looking at nutrigenomic medicine, you don't need the name of a disease. So what we find in practice is, so we've got a patient on a program. This is the one with the thyroid, gut and skin problems, let's say. They come back after a couple of months and the gut's improved and the skin's improved. Thyroid's improved a bit, but not much. Then and only then would I start drilling down and investigating what aspect of the thyroid is it? What have I missed here? What else do I need to do? When you treat patients that way, you don't put them into economic burnout with a whole lot of tests up front. And it's tragic because I hear of people who go through that scenario, spend a heap of money on a lot of tests, and they've got no money left then for the treatment. Yeah. So you don't achieve anything that way. If we can look at those core principles of cellular function and fix what we can see generically, then we can see what's left. Some patients don't need to do anything else. Yeah. We've pretty much got that controlled. And that's not to say that we don't use some food supplements. We probably do need to use some, but they're not isolated synthetic vitamin and mineral supplements, which come with a whole lot of excipients, which often aren't disclosed anyway. There are other tablet-making additives and so on that come with a supplement. You might look at the label of your bottle and see vitamin B1 written on the label, so many milligrams. But you don't know that the factory that made that vitamin B1 had to put some additive in there to keep that stable or to make the powder flow or some other reason.
Yes. Yeah. And with detoxification.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another, so obviously we're working with the vitamins, no, not the vitamins, the food biochemicals in order to speed up, you know, mm-hmm. detoxification or allow detoxification processes. At what point would you then use something, you know, like sulforaphane products in order to, or something that increases sulforaphane in order to?
Well, I probably do that right up front because I want to fast track the process. And we know that not all patients will be able to optimise their diet and lifestyle. That's the ideal, but it isn't going to happen with some people. So if we can use a food concentrate that can fast track the process, we do that because we want them feeling better as soon as possible. It's not just a matter of upholding a philosophy. We want to get the patient feeling well. So I would use that right up front. Now, interestingly enough, with sulforaphane, which is derived from broccoli sprouts largely, if somebody's gut is so dysfunctional that they have too many of the wrong proportion of bugs living in the gut and not enough of the friendly commensal organisms, what the sulforaphane can do, it can actually create die-off in those bad bugs, pathogens they may be. They might only just be what we call pathobionts, which are a bit naughty, but they're not really seriously disease-causing, but they cause a lot of bloating and discomfort in the patient. We sometimes need to start that sulforaphane dose fairly slowly and gradually increase it as the patient tolerates it. Not everybody is like that, but we always like to warn people because, you know, if you're going to feel worse before you feel better, you might be very happy with the clinician who's recommended it. Yeah. But that's the power of a nutrigenomically active molecule like sulforaphane. It gets to work virtually straight away, and it's a potent activator of this cellular defense switch. And it's the molecule that's capable then of upregulating these several hundred protective genes, which is the antioxidant enzymes, the glutathione production, the detoxification enzymes. And detoxification runs across a broad spectrum. It's not just detoxifying things like, you know, benzene residues out of motor vehicle exhaust. It's also detoxifying internal molecules like our hormones. Once they've done their job, they need to be broken down and safely eliminated. Estrogen's a common one that clinicians talk about. So sulforaphane is capable of safely degrading that estrogen so that it doesn't attack the DNA. One of the things that happens, and this is why we have estrogen-dependent cancers, if estrogen's not safely broken down, it will cause mutation in our DNA, and mutated DNA is the forerunner to many types of cancer. So that's why it's so important to be sure we've got proper detoxification processes going, because that's the thing that stops your DNA mutating, and that's the ultimate disease we want to prevent, is cancer.
Yes, and everything that supports the body detoxifying is obviously going to stop some of those toxins from getting into the nucleus of the cell and, you know, switching on inflammatory processes or, yeah. Because I think one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that just about every disease on the planet at the moment is inflammatory or toxic in as a causative.
Well, that's because of these primary upstream mechanisms in the cell. So redox balance is one of them. So that's talking about free radical activity. The other one's inflammation. And then there's detoxification, and the other one's energy production. So we need to be sure our cells are capable of producing energy. So they can't do anything else if they're not producing enough energy. And then there's a final process which is important called methylation.
Yeah.
So when we put those processes together and we're activating them all at the same time, that's when we're getting our optimum response to cell function. And that's when we're likely to be promoting repair and recovery.
So the methylation, that's to do with the MTHFR gene? Or is that a different thing?
No, it is to do with MTHFR, but that's just one in the process. And I have to say this about MTHFR. I see so many people who go, oh, I've got MTHFR, that explains everything that's ever been wrong with me. No, it doesn't.
Yes.
If we go back to the food process again, I'll go back to MTHFR. So MTHFR is like you've got this metabolic pathway and you've got a gate and you've got to be able to jump over the gate to get to the next stage. So some people have an MTHFR gene that means the gate's too high and you can't jump over it. So what has been discovered is if you give a methylated folate supplement, you can kind of avoid the adverse effect of that MTHFR. So practitioners give methylfolate supplements, thinking that that's the only solution. If we ate lots of green leafy vegetables, the naturally occurring folate in green leafy vegetables is 65% 5-methylfolate. You don't need the supplement. That's been orchestrated by the supplement industry, and it really annoys me because we're getting people hooked on pills when they should be getting hooked on learning how to follow nature. I mean, we didn't know anything about methylation. When I was in clinical practice, never heard of this whole concept of methylation causing disease, never heard of MTHFR. That's come subsequent to that. How did I get patients well for 30-odd years and I never knew about methylfolate and I never knew about MTHFR? So I didn't know that because I was encouraging them to eat naturally occurring folate-rich foods, we were overcoming that anyway and we didn't know anything about that gene variant. So putting it back into perspective again, we can do it with food. That is the reality of it. Nature's figured this out long ago. And 66% of humans on the planet have a variant in that MTHFR gene. So that doesn't mean that two-thirds of us have this terrible disease that we can't overcome and must have a 5-methylfolate supplement. It doesn't mean that. Nature has adapted to this and it's in the food. We just have to eat it.
Yeah, in the same way that about 30% of us have got the celiac gene, you know, so but people aren't dropping over like flies all day every day because of, well, maybe they are, but because of poor diet. Yeah, it's, I remember I did clinic experience with someone who made his own supplements going back nearly 30 years ago. And I remember him saying to me, and as a young naturopath, it's probably the worst thing to be told. He said, 95% of people won't change their diet anyway. So you've got no choice but to prescribe supplements. And I remembered thinking, huh, and I was young and broke at the time. And I was thinking, well, how does anyone afford, you know, to put supplements everywhere where diet should be? And I was probably lucky to have a lot of broke clients. Maybe I was attracting broke clients at the time as well, you know. And so we had to sort of go through the diet and do what we can. And you find out people eat all sorts of rubbish in there, you know, that they have no concept. People start with, yep, I've got a pretty healthy diet. And then you can start going through it. You go, really? You think this is healthy? Not quite what you say as a clinician, but yeah, it's amazing how people think they're on a healthy diet when there's not a lot healthy in there.
Well, they do. And I agree with you that, you know, one of the questions I would always ask is, how do you feel about your diet? Is it healthy? Yeah, we eat really well. And then you start dissecting it and there's a slow education process to sort that out. Mind you, I'm not extreme in my views either. I mean, I always, unless somebody's severely diabetic or something, I've always had the 90% rule that says 90% of the time, eat the right thing. The other 10% of the time, whatever you like, I don't even need to know. Which means Monday to Friday, pretty much stick to a healthy routine. On the weekends, let go a bit. You might be socialising, you might be out, have it, whatever you want.
Yeah. So a description of the diet that you recommend would be like Mediterranean. Would that be a description generally?
That would be a broad description, although I do cut the refined cereals out.
Yes.
I mean, I don't ever recommend white rice, but I'm happy for people who eat brown basmati rice. And you can buy unrefined or less refined forms of pasta. There's a fair variety of those things.
Yes.
And even if you eat white pasta now and again, it's not the end of the world. It's, you know, life's about balance, and whatever you're going to do with your food, it's got to be a lifelong habit. So it's got to be something that's comfortable. Initially, I think a lot of patients are horrified, going, oh, I can't cut sugar out, I can't do this, I can't do that. But if you can persuade them to gradually make these changes, they'll come back to you months later and go, you know, I didn't believe you that day you said this to me, but you're right. I had a piece of cheesecake yesterday when I was out and I thought, ugh, that is really sickly sweet.
Because it starts to change your taste buds. It starts to change.
And it takes about 3 weeks, I've found. I mean, if I'd have a type 2 diabetic patient, I would actually like to get one fairly early in the process, soon after the diagnosis. They're good and scared, and they will do anything that you ask them to do. And you can really prove the point that it does just take about 3 weeks to make changes that stop upsetting the patient's routine. They think they can't do it, but they're so frightened. They'll do whatever it takes. And after a while, they go, this is easy. I like it.
That's right.
Eating white
and I sort of say to people, you need to find what works for you. What do you enjoy? You know, then just start changing it little by little.
Yeah, I usually start with the breakfast. I think a lot of damage is done in the breakfast for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the box cereals are a terrible choice no matter what. But secondly, if they do have dysfunction in their blood sugar regulation, they'll start destroying it first meal of the day. And so they'll, you know, the blood sugar will spike after, let's say, a bowl of cornflakes and a cup of coffee. By mid-morning, the blood sugar's dropped right back down below fasting, and they're crawling around looking for something sweet to eat. And that's where the drama begins. They'll go and get some garbage from the coffee shop or whatever. Up goes the blood sugar, down it goes again by lunch, and they're just on this seesaw, blood sugar up, down all through the day. If you can get them stable with a good breakfast, which will last them for several hours, if not right through till lunchtime, with low glycemic index choices that don't spike the glucose, you can much more readily get control of what's happening later on in the day. So I start with breakfast, and I mean, I don't like to overwhelm people and try and change the whole lot all in one go. You'll occasionally get a patient who just says, just tell me what I have to do, I'll do what you say. But I think it's better to just make it gradual, because people live in families, in homes where other people don't want to change their diet straight away necessarily either. So it's a large management exercise, as you know, Madonna. It's not just here's a diet sheet, eat this and see me when you do it. It's fitting it into a lifestyle. And, you know, I would prefer with a patient who would come to me with a chronic disease of some kind where I know we've got big changes to make, to say bring your husband, wife, partner back at the next visit, because I'd like to be able to explain to them what I'm going to tell you. Because as you know, the patient goes home, they tell the partner, and they can never tell the story quite the way they heard it.
Yes.
And I think you get a much better family commitment to the process if you can at least have the parents of the family or the couple of the family hearing the story. And hopefully the other partner is supportive enough to be able to say, yeah, I'm happy to do that. I'll eat that too. It's probably good for me too.
Yeah. Yes. You will always have someone stubborn in the household, of course.
Yes, so, sometimes they're teenagers who drive the menu.
Yes. Yeah. I was chatting about the happiness study. Do you remember there was a happiness study done around 2015, and they looked at the life cycle of, you know, humans, and people had higher happiness scores just after they were married and just after they'd had a baby. And then they had lower happiness scores, you know, for the first year after having a baby and any time they had teenagers in the house, which is the bit that amused me at the time. So I think everyone laughed, you know, when that came
up. Yes.
So we've only got a few minutes left. So what would your advice to people be just to get started?
Oh, just to get started, well, yeah. I guess a couple of things. First of all, increase your vegetable intake. Now, what I do teach is this. If you get 600 grams of non-starchy vegetables into your diet every day, there's clinical trial done on that, and it shows that inflammation drops dramatically. So what I ask people to do is go to the fridge, pull out the vegetables you've got there and pile them onto the scales, non-starchy, this is not the potatoes and corn and so on, until you get 600 grams, and that's your goal for your daily intake.
Great tip.
It'll be a lot more than most people think, but there is a clinical trial that confirms that. So that's the first thing to do. The second thing to do is get rid of processed foods out of your pantry bit by bit. Get rid of the processed breakfast cereals. Rolled oats, make your own muesli, Bircher muesli with yogurt and so on, that's a good start. Eggs for breakfast, tomatoes, mushrooms, grill, that sort of thing, alternate that around. But the processed foods really have no place in any menu. They're really devoid of so many nutrients and contain a whole lot of additives that nobody really needs. So that'd be the key things that I'd be looking at.
Yes, because every time we're eating an anti-food, we're doing something that's creating inflammation and toxicity in our body.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And if you're going to get in that 600 grams of veggies, you need to remove something to allow the space to be able to do that.
Yes, you do. And it's usually the junk and the processed stuff. Yeah.
So, and then the junk, predominantly the refined, getting the refined foods out of the diet. And I suppose with that, would you be thinking the coffees and things like that?
No, I don't.
Not initially?
No, I don't think there's a problem drinking coffee for most people. I know you can look at the genetics and you can see that some people don't handle coffee well. But look, if you want one cup of coffee first up in the morning, have it. There are lots of polyphenols, which are health promoting in freshly ground coffee. I don't know about instant. So I don't see any issue in doing that for most people, unless you're desperately ill at the time, in which case you have to cut it out. But no, I mean, I'm not interested in extremism. I don't have a problem with most people having a glass of red wine if that's what they want to do.
Yes.
I guess it's the Mediterranean model again, and using olive oil. I'm not in favour of people drowning their food now in coconut oil. We seem to get these trends and we get hooked on something. There's nothing wrong with coconut oil, but it doesn't have to be the mainstay of your diet.
Yes, and it's in everything now. And I don't do coconut. I had coconut-flavoured antibiotics when I was a baby, so I can't touch it. They came in and they went out.
So it's a saturated fat. It doesn't bring polyphenols with it. Olive oil is a monounsaturated fat. It's heaps of polyphenols if you buy the extra virgin olive oil. And there's lots of good studies on the value of olive oil.
Yes. Beautiful. And for those practitioners who wanted to do your study course, how do they find you?
Well, you can go to the Cell Logic website, cell-logic.com.au. So we have the GEM protocol, which is our foundation course for looking at nutrigenomic medicine. We're just opening up a new program called Conversations in Nutrigenomic Medicine, which starts in July. So that's also on the website. So it's a couple of different ways of learning this sort of medicine.
And who can do these courses? Do you have to be a
nutritionist? You have to be a clinician to do it. So anybody who is practicing as a clinician with some background in nutrition, I mean, there's a variety of different people who have the credentials for doing that, but without some background in nutrition, you wouldn't be able to do it.
It won't make sense.
It's not.
Yes.
We sometimes have individuals untrained in health at all wanting to do it, and we don't allow it. I mean, they won't be able to manage it. I mean, I say you don't need a lot of science. You just eat this food. Perhaps I'm simplifying it in that. There is a lot you need to know to practice it. We say the science is complex, but the implementation is simple.
Yes.
But you do need to understand the science to know how to involve the subtle nuances from one patient to the next.
Yes, absolutely. Because what a surprise, we're all individuals. Well, that has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Christine. It's been wonderful having you on the program. I'll talk
thank
to you again
soon.
Thank you
so much for the opportunity, Madonna. It's been
thank
good
you.
Fun.
Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.